Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on Inside Appalachia, ever heard the word Afrolachian? In the 1990s, a poet in Kentucky named Frank X. Walker came up with the term. It refers to African Americans living in Appalachia.
My critics have pledged allegiance to a study that said Appalachia is more striking in its homogeneity than its diversity, and that rural Appalachia lags behind rural America, and metropolitan Appalachia lags behind metropolitan America, to perhaps plant the idea that Appalachia was not really America.
The word gave rise to a group of Afrolachian writers called the Afrolachian Poets, including Crystal Wilkinson.
Anytime that you can come across something that gives you a stronger sense of self-identity, the name, what we call ourselves, is important.
Those stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
To us, it was about making the invisible visible, or giving voice to a previously muted or silenced voice.
That's Frank X. Walker, a Kentucky native who teaches at the University of Kentucky. Walker is one of the founding members of a group called the Afrolachian Poets. About 36 writers have been invited to join the group. Walker says the invitations are reserved for authors with Appalachian connections who write about social justice. We'll hear more about what the Afrolachian Poets write about a little later in the show. But we'll start off today with their next installment of The Struggle to Stay. In 2014, when Kira Soleil Dahl was just 17, they formed a small theater company out of West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle in Shepherdstown, a historic artsy college town just miles from Maryland, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. We're using the pronouns they, them, and their when referring to Kira because they identify as gender fluid or gender queer, which are terms within the LGBT community. Kira was born female, but doesn't identify exclusively as female or male, but somewhere in the middle. It was theater that helped Kira come to terms with questions about gender and identity. It helped with one of the darkest periods of Kira's life during middle school. Kira wants their theater company to be licensed and to be a sustainable business here in Appalachia. Kira wants to be taken seriously, recognized for their talents, and make a profit. Part of Kira's struggle to stay rests on this dream. Reporter Liz McCormick has been following Kira's story for about 1 year.
It's August 2016, here in Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
My name is Kira Soleil Dahl, and I'm deciding whether to stay or leave to pursue better artistic opportunities. I really want to stay, but I'm told I really should leave. So I'm trying to make what some people say is impossible happen and make a very high quality of work in a place that a lot of people stigmatize as not a high quality place to work.
Kira sits on the iconic stone wall, eating a burger and fries. They're sporting a t-shirt with the Whiskey Shine and Pantomime Productions logo, or WSP for short. That's the name of Kira's theater group. Kira's dream is for WSP Productions to become an official company. They'd love to own a business or a small profit theater company before turning 20, but knows it won't be easy. It's about 9 p.m. This is Kira's favorite time of day. We walk from the Shepherdstown Wall down to the Potomac River on the West Virginia side. It's here where Kira comes to think.
So we are currently at the Potomac River, and I love this place. I've come to this place so many times throughout my adolescence and my adult life. Mm-hmm.
It's dark, except for the stars and the reflection of the moon on the water. Street lamps twinkle in the darkness from a bridge connecting West Virginia and Maryland just a few hundred feet away. Cicadas chirp loudly around us. We stand on a concrete boat ramp, just steps away from the warm water, and we're the only ones here.
I love bodies of water. It really helps me think. I love coming down here to think. I've had a lot of really great discussions with people that have come and gone through my life. And almost every single conversation, I always am pushing this dream that we can be successful artists in West Virginia, that we don't have to just go across the river, we don't have to go across the country, we don't have to go anywhere to make the work that we want to make.
Shepherdstown is Kira's home. Though Kira was born in California, they moved to West Virginia at the age of 6.
And this place is so beautiful. How would you ever want to leave it? And I hope that I'm not the only one that sees that. I hope that I'm not the only one that sees that there's something really incredible happening here. And my fear of both leaving or staying is the fact that it won't ever get acknowledged unless I go elsewhere. But if I go elsewhere, it won't be derived from this place, this beautiful, beautiful place.
Just a few days after this interview, I attended the second day of auditions for Kira's latest production, William Shakespeare's classic tragedy, Hamlet.
Ben, first lines, had I but time, monosyllabic, slow down.
Auditions were held at Kira's parents' house, just a few miles from the heart of Shepherdstown.
But let it be, once again, monosyllabic, use that period as a pause. Horatio, I am dead.
Shakespeare has actually played a large role in Kira's life. In fact, it was one of the playwright's other plays, A Midsummer Night's Dream, that was a turning point for Kira.
When I was in junior high, I was in my first Shakespeare play. And I was really confused. Everybody's hormones were crazy and vicious. And so were the people. And I didn't really fit in with the girls. I was really bad at being a girl. I'm still really bad at being a girl. And I didn't really fit in with the boys because I still was a girl. At least I thought. And I got bullied really hard.
Kira says this point was the most difficult time of their life. Kira was beginning to recognize they were genderqueer and struggling with identity.
I just felt so lost and confused and kind of empty. And I really genuinely thought that, like, if things didn't get better by high school, I would try to opt out in whatever way that applied, whether it meant, like, leaving, running away, or, like, actually attempting suicide, whatever that looked like. I knew that that was very real for me because I just did not enjoy what was going on at the time. And that's, like, nobody's fault. It really isn't. But that's how I felt mentally.
Things changed for 12-year-old Kira when they were cast as Helena in A Midsummer Night's Dream, a character who's an outcast and no other characters seem to love. Kira connected with Helena to a T. And for the first time, Kira felt in control.
It finally gave me something to connect to. And as a weird seventh grade kid who doesn't know how to act like a person or a girl, that was a really big deal. That was a really big deal. I learned that I could pretend. And if I could pretend, I could make it through. And then in learning how to pretend, I realized everybody else was doing the exact same thing, sometimes without realizing it. So it took me out of that very vulnerable place of feeling very put down by my peers and by myself and being in a weird body and not knowing what that was and coming into a queerness that I did not know I had. And it gave me not just an activity, but like a philosophy, like a way of life, to kind of fake it till you made it, or fake it till you fake it some more. And although that sounds kind of terrible, that is absolutely what I needed in that moment. And that's part of the reason that theater is like my life.
It's my philosophy. It's my world. It's how I see the world. And it saved my life.
A few years after playing Helena in A Midsummer Night's Dream, Kira came out as bisexual to friends and family, and that was tough.
I would say that there are definitely some growing pains, but my family supports me as a person pretty much unconditionally, and I hope to see those growing pains actually be real growth in both their person and mine and our relationship. It's hard, I'm not gonna lie.
And then during their senior year of high school, Kira came out as genderqueer or gender fluid.
Being a pansexual non-binary person just means I don't necessarily identify really strongly as both male or female. I just simply feel kind of masculine, and that's just fine. So I'm just a person. That's all that means.
And then underneath this self-discovery was theater. Theater helped Kira feel more self-assured, more grounded while coming out.
I would love you to come down. I'm just going to read you down.
Back
there.
At the Hamlet auditions, Kira's feeling nervous but excited to get the show cast. We're in the basement of Kira's parents' house. On the patio outside, a handful of other local actors, all millennials, chat, smoke cigarettes, and wait to be called in to audition. Inside, Kira's boyfriend, Ben Johnson, is reading for the part of Hamlet. Kira gives him some pointers.
I want you to run it one more time, and I want you to, once again, keep it in shock. Don't let the emotion go over just yet, right? Yeah. It's happening now. This is like it's like that EMT kind of scenario, right? This is right now.
Heaven make thee free of it. I follow thee. I am dead, Horatio. Wretched queen, adieu. You that look...
I'm really hoping that this production kind of establishes us as really credible, right? I want people to realize the talent that I've realized in these people. And it's really helpful to do that with, like, a big-name production.
As thou art a man, give me the cup! Go, by heaven, I'll have it. Good Horatio.
In just a couple of months, Kira's latest theater production, Hamlet, will open to the public. But how will Kira handle the weight of directing such a big show, one where Kira rests so much hope? And how welcome does Kira feel here, given their gender identity? More next time on Kira's Struggle to Stay. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
You can hear more of Kira's Struggle to Stay story on the next episode of Inside Appalachia. This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Appalachian? In the 1990s, a poet in Kentucky named Frank X. Walker came up with the term. It refers to African Americans living in Appalachia. Let's listen to some of Walker's presentation at the 2016 ASA conference.
My first year at the Kentucky Book Festival, a white man walked up to my booth and announced that he'd been looking at his map all day and didn't see no Appalachia nowhere. I smiled, considered my many optional responses, and asked him if he'd been using a black and white map or a full color map. When he responded with black and white, I reckon, I said, well, that's the problem. You need a colored map to see Appalachia.
Walker said the man walked away, scratching his head, still not sure how to find Appalachia. Now, while you can't find it on a literal map,
Walker's first poetry collection, called Afrolatia, promotes the idea of Afrolatia as both a physical and spiritual place that was previously undefined and unrealized. And finding Afrolatia, or rather, reclaiming Afrolatia, that's what Walker spoke about to a packed auditorium.
My critics have pledged allegiance to a study that said Appalachia is more striking in its homogeneity than its diversity, and that rural Appalachia lags behind rural America, urban Appalachia lags behind urban America, and metropolitan Appalachia lags behind metropolitan America, to perhaps plant the idea that Appalachia was not really America.
Walker went on to name many African American social activists and intellectual thinkers who are from Appalachia, but who are often not identified as Appalachians.
When people talk about the father of Black History Week, Carter G. Woodson, who was born in New Canton, Virginia, a former sharecropper and miner who attended Berea College before going on to become the second African American to receive a PhD from Harvard, neither he nor perhaps an even more famous American ex-slave, Virginia's Booker T. Washington, I ever recognized as sons of Appalachia.
And he called for fellow Appalachians to reclaim African-American cultural gems who were from the Appalachian South, but are often excluded from studies about the region as a whole.
But people talk about the woman known as the mother of the blues, Rome, Georgia's Bessie Smith, Black Mountain, North Carolina's Grammy Award-winning Roberta Flack. Y'all know Killing Me Softly with his song.
Even before Frank X. Walker published his first book of poetry, he coined the term Afrolatian back in 1991 after he found Webster's dictionary definition of Appalachian read white residents from the mountains. When Walker discovered the definition didn't include his identity, he decided to create his own word that described people of African descent from the Appalachian region, Afrolatian. Today, the Oxford Dictionary defines the Afrolatian as an African-American who is native to or resides in Appalachia. Walker says that folks across the country identify with the term Afrolatian, while the Afrolatian poets are a formal group of writers who tackle social justice issues. The group is careful how they use the word. So when Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin selected the Afrolatian poets as one of 10 winners for the 2016 Community Arts Award, the writers rejected it. Walker says Governor Bevin supported legislation that prevents felons from having the right to vote, attacked environmental policies and other issues that the Afrolatian poets consider to be socially unjust. In his talk, Walker also spoke about his friend and mentor, Edward Cabell, co-author of the book Blacks in Appalachia.
It says, Black Diamond was another name for coal, and other than farming and the railroad, coal mining is what sustained our people in the mountains. Black people in the mountains are like diamonds because our culture is so rich.
Cabell also told Walker that Black Diamonds is a phrase that sometimes refers to Black coal miners. Another Afrolatian poet has used the term Black Diamonds in her writing. Her name is Crystal Good.
Black Diamond, 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 Black Diamond.
That's Good singing a piece of one of her poems, What You Know About Black Diamonds. Good writes about race and cultural identity in Appalachia, and about how the national media portrays Appalachians with negative stereotypes. These topics can be considered social justice issues, so Good was a good fit for the Afrolatian Poets group. Right after the 2014 election, Good shared a poem she'd written about racism and Appalachian culture, called Appalachian Blackface. She says she wrote the poem to show connections she sees between blackface performers of the 1800s and today's political leaders. Let's listen to her reading an excerpt of this poem and giving her interpretation. The poem was performed at the 2014 Summit on Race Matters, and the rest of the interview was recorded in our Charleston studio. A warning, this poem contains language that some people may consider offensive.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you a story. It's a strange, fascinating, and awful tale. Staged in West Virginia during the 21st century, when they developed a unique craft, an art form of performance known as Appalachian Blackface. Appalachian Blackface was a spinoff of the minstrel shows of the 1800s, featuring working-class white men dressed up as plantation slaves. These white men imitated Negro music and dance forms in parodies known as old-time nigger shows, with colorful comic darkies, as they called them. The minstrel shows had by the 1840s become one of the central events in the culture of the Democratic Party.
There's many layers to this idea, but I'm looking at Appalachian blackface in context of the old minstrel shows, where white Southerners predominantly would put court grease on their faces and sort of mimic and lampoon African Americans in very offensive type skits. And I'm using that parallel as sort of the catalyst to the poem, suggesting that in Appalachia we are putting coal on our face, our politicians and other entities, to mimic in many ways the miner.
Appalachian blackface, or the 21st century Appalachian minstrel shows, were set on the stage of West Virginia politics. During campaign season, Appalachian blackface actors would smear coal across their faces to blacken their skin as they mimicked the miners they hoped to represent. Appalachian blackface performers, dressed in costumes of fine tailored suits, carried shotguns and pretended to be defensive soldiers in a theatrical war on coal. A fantasy created as a backdrop for their minstrel parodies, parodies that pretended to support miners and Appalachian communities.
This idea is so emotional, and it invokes so much emotion that it's brilliant in terms of, you know, putting it as a backdrop, as a theater that gives you character, it gives you plot points, it gives you an enemy, and it gives you a hero. But I think there's many people out there that would agree with me in saying that there's no war on coal.
Just as the minstrel performers of the 1800s created songs and skits that mocked African Americans, so did Appalachian blackface performers mock the intelligence of the region's people and the coal miners by promising them generations of jobs and health. Appalachian blackface performers romanticized the plight of the miner with expressions of admiration, pretending to support the happy-go-lucky miner on the mountain, the dandified fool, often singing a traditional tune, "It's our way of life, of life. It's our way of life, of life."
We are part of the show. We're tap dancing and singing to entertain the entitled, right? Because we're so distracted in how the world sees us.
That was Appalachian poet Crystal Good talking about her 2014 poem, Appalachian Blackface. So 2 years have gone by, and we wanted to check back in with Good to find out how she feels about that poem now, and about how politics in Appalachia are so deeply rooted in coal. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to bring back coal jobs, and he wants support in all 55 counties in West Virginia. A higher percentage of voters supported Donald Trump in West Virginia than in any other state, according to a national vote tracker. Meanwhile, West Virginia's only billionaire, business owner Jim Justice, was elected the state's new governor. Justice owns coal mines in several states and the prestigious Greenbrier Hotel in West Virginia. Trump spoke about bringing back coal and coal jobs, while supporters at his rallies were often shown on national media outlets to be hostile and violent. So Crystal Good, as an African American, was a little hesitant to attend a Trump rally. But what she saw surprised her. Good spoke with their producer Roxy Todd about her experience at the rally and how coal has reemerged as a political theme in the most recent election.
I frame it this way. If your mother's dying and one doctor walks in, let's say Dr. Hillary, and says, "Your mother's dying, I'm sorry, we'll give her some medication, she'll pass away peacefully." And then another doctor comes in, you know, Dr. Donald, and says, "You know what? Your mother was an amazing woman. We're not going to give up on her. We're going to try. We're going to try homeopathic. We're going to try to get some, you know, special bees from another place. We're going to try what we can in order to give her life." Now, even if you think that homeopathic remedies or whatever prescription is unlikely, there's hope in that. And that's kind of how I saw this election in West Virginia really just going to bat for Donald Trump, because what was at stake is jobs, yes, but also an identity of who we are. And that's been a part of our state branding from my entire life.
I do want to ask you about the Trump rally that you attended and what you experienced there and saw. Can you talk about that day?
Well, what stood out to me was it was raining and I was standing in line and I thought, why am I here standing in the rain? Right? It just started raining. And wouldn't you know, a gentleman came up and said, ma'am, would you like my umbrella? And I said, thank you. Yes, I do. And this gentleman stood in the rain and let me have his umbrella. So I probably wasn't there more than 5 minutes when this happened. I thought, oh, those scary Trump people sharing their umbrellas. Then once I got inside, you know, Civic Center is pretty fancy, you know, in terms of you know, the people kept coming in and coming in. And I went to the concession stand and I stood in line. And these fellows were in front of me and they were coal miners. And they were talking about how they might get laid off and talking about somebody else who had gotten laid off and he was getting a divorce and, you know, might lose his truck. I mean, this was a real conversation happening in front of me at the concession stand. It was three of them. And they got their food, or they were organizing their food, you know, they give it to you in a little tray. And when he paid, when he was going to, the fella at the concession stand said, do you want anything else? And he said, whatever she wants, just put it on my tab. I hadn't had a conversation with these gentlemen. I just thought, wow, that's very kind and generous of them, who they're in this conversation about, you know, being laid off, being coal miners, you know, and just thought, well, you know, and I said, well, they'll take a popcorn, you know, and then they went on their way. So that's my second impression. Nothing had started yet. And then, of course, you know, the rally started, and it was much sort of like a revival and very theatrical to me and, you know, very played on emotion. I kind of look at things through, you know, a marketing lens, and it was just families all around me, you know, sitting there. So it would be a grandpa and a grandma and daughter and son and a little boy or a little girl, you know. These are West Virginia families that I was sitting beside. I didn't see any fist fights or arguments, and nobody pointed at me, and nobody, you know, everyone in my section was very well behaved. This was so contrary to what I'd seen on television, you know, in the way that it was portrayed. You know, I could sense and feel, you know, a lot of propaganda and emotional, you know, and Trump put on his hat, and, you know, all of that stuff. But
His miner hat.
And then when we left, the Bernie folks were out there and they were yelling like F Trump, right? And the big signs. And I'm watching all these families come out, right? With the kids, you know, and they're walking by folks with big Bernie signs saying F Trump, except they weren't saying the F, right? And I thought, well, that's not right. You know?
Getting cussed at by the Bernie supporters.
Yeah. You know, because, you know, these were West Virginia families that were coming out, walking past that. These little kids. So it was a little, you know, it started to frame things for me. And that's why I think it's so important to have primary sources in life, you know? I didn't go to that rally because I was supporting Donald Trump. I was curious. I wasn't afraid to move into that space of, you know, I wanted to know what that was like. Was there a lot of offensive T-shirts that people were wearing and selling and, you know what I'm saying, things like that? I would say yes, you know, but for the most part, I just saw West Virginia families that wanted to believe in, want somebody to give them, you know, give them hope. And that's when I really, you know, that's when I started to see where this, you know, it was clear West Virginia was going to vote for Trump. But my experience there was not scary. And as a fact, people were really nice and polite and kind and considerate and conversation and, you know, all of those things. And then I left thinking, feeling kind of bad that I went in with reservations. And I went in wondering how I was going to be treated or what I was going to hear. And then I had to think, these are West Virginia people, you know? This is my state, you know?
Good is a self-proclaimed West Virginia senator of social media. She owns a social media and marketing consulting business, and during the legislative session, she also advocates for various issues at the state capitol, including efforts to develop industrial hemp in West Virginia. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear Crystal Good talk more about how she feels about the way the media has portrayed West Virginians during and in the months since the 2016 election, and how she feels about how the conversation around race and racism in West Virginia that's traveled around the globe throughout the 2016 presidential campaign. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today we're learning more about the Appalachian Poets, a group of authors who write about social justice. We've been hearing from one of the Appalachian Poets, Crystal Good, and one of her social justice platforms, racism. And contrary to what we may see in the media and what Webster's Dictionary used to say, not all Appalachians are white. According to a report by the Appalachian Regional Commission, more than 17% of Appalachian residents identified with a racial or ethnic minority group between 2010 and 2014. The statistics break down like this. More than 9% of the Appalachian population is black, and more than 4% is Hispanic or Latino. And while it is true that here in Appalachia we have our issues with racism, the media seems to have jumped with alarming eagerness at the opportunity to once again show the racism exists here. Take, for instance, the incident last month when a Clay County Economic Development Coordinator posted a racist remark about Michelle Obama on Facebook. The woman, Pamela Taylor, was temporarily suspended from her job, and the Clay mayor resigned following a public outcry. Appalachian poet Crystal Good says she thinks it's good that stories like these are told, but they shouldn't be all that West Virginia is known for.
When the news came out about the woman in Clay County that made the comments about Michelle Obama, well, if we probably did a Facebook search, right, for the last year, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, right, we probably could have found things like that and much worse coming from any of our 55 counties, right? But because this year was driven by the identity politics and the ism politics, that went to become a national story to brand West Virginia, right, as this racist place. In fact, you could probably find any state in America, right, where you could find those kind of comments. And probably if you did more research, and I know that she worked in a certain office, so she was supposed to have some more composure and so forth. I just think that that went around the world, right? because of this election. And I think we're going to have to hold on tight because I think that's going to be what we're going to endure the next, you know, for the coming years. We're not going to get out of this until we can really move in our developing our economy, you know, and really creating the infrastructure and the jobs that we need here.
Your sons are graduating from university?
I have my oldest son will be graduating next year. He's third year, Marshall University. He's in a digital forensics program.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
And is he going to stay in West Virginia?
Probably not. just because of the job market and also sort of the need to go out and gain some resume experience. And then, but we'll see. He wants to. He wants to stay in West Virginia.
Does he feel like he has a community here? Does he feel safe here?
Yeah, absolutely.
When people, you know, outside West Virginia contact you and say, like, Crystal, what's going on in West Virginia? Mm. What do you say?
Well, after the election, I had calls from friends from France. What's going on in America? And, other people, it's the same thing. Just come and visit and see for yourself. You know, I have 3 black teenagers, and as the world would have it, you would think that they are in extreme danger. I don't think my children are any greater danger here than anywhere else in America. I don't believe in safe spaces, you know, but I do think that West Virginia is right there at that point where we're going to make it, or we're just looking at another long chapter of really difficult, perhaps maybe even greater than our history books have told us about. But I'm staying hopeful. I mean, I'm staying here and I'm staying hopeful, and I think there's a lot of other people that are too, and I certainly don't know everything and anything that's going on in the state, but I have my feeling self, my creative self, that says, you know what? There's still life here and there's still growth, and what a great blank canvas when I think about, hey, no, there wasn't a word called Afro-Latchan until Frank X. Walker made it up, right? And so I think there's many things to create here. And sometimes this tension, the struggle, is just the moment when, poof, you know, something manifests. And maybe that's a little bit too idealistic for people. But then again, I always get to slip into the notion that I'm a poet.
That was Crystal Good, one of the Afro-Latchan poets, a business owner, and a mother, speaking with Roxy Todd. We're interested in hearing your reactions to the latest election. We're working on an upcoming episode about what the change in administration could mean for Appalachia. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag MyAppalachia. Now let's hear from another woman named Crystal, who is also part of the group The Afro-Latchan Poets. Crystal Wilkinson is one of the original writers who began The Afro-Latchan Poets along with Frank X. Walker. Wilkinson is originally from Casey County, Kentucky. She lived most of her life on Indian Creek. Growing up, she had several people in her family who suffered from mental illness. It's one of the social justice issues that she writes about. Earlier this year, Wilkinson told WMMT's Kelly Haywood in an interview that what got her into being a writer, she says, was her grandmother and growing up in the mountains.
Well, I think I was probably always a writer. My grandmother always told the story, and it sounds really romantic, one of those classic sort of writer fishing tales, so I'll tell you. But she always says that after she had read all the books in the house to me, and then later on I was able to read them myself, and after she'd read them all to me and I'd read them all myself, then I started writing my own when I ran out. And I think that was part of it, but the culture there, one, was conducive to solitude, because I was an only child. I was my mother's only child, and I was being grandparent raised there on a farm up in that holler. So I think the solitude was one of the things, but I was also sort of born into sort of a classic artistic mountain family. I mean, my grandmother made quilts, and those were the things that were being done in the family. My mother played piano by ear and was a writer as well. So I think it was sort of a natural inclination. And I was also a very imaginative child, and part of that, I think, was bred from the solitude as well.
Wilkinson says she didn't always identify as Appalachian, but as she's grown older, she's grown to understand that her identity is both as an African American and as an Appalachian.
You can look at me and see that I'm African American, but when I start talking, and then you get, you see the raised eyebrows, and then it's the questions like, you know, do you feel safe there? Well, do you feel safe in your home? Like, it's home. You know, of course I feel safe. And a lot of other questions that come down the pike regarding race.
Wilkinson teaches at Berea College, and she's encountered students who, like her, didn't necessarily identify as Appalachian before they started reading Appalachian literature.
Appalachia wasn't a word that my grandparents attached to themselves, and wasn't a word that I attached to myself until I got much older. And I find that to be a similar experience with a lot of my students at Berea. They grow up a particular way, and you're just good country people. You know, some people refer to themselves as Appalachians and others don't, who may geographically be from Appalachia or culturally be from Appalachia.
Wilkinson says the Afro-Latchian term has inspired and even empowered other folks to claim their Appalachian identities.
Because I, you know, as I've traveled all over Appalachia, one of the things that's been like really wonderful is like when I was in Radford, Virginia, I met a woman and she said, well, you know, we were Italian and a lot of people always thought that we were different. My father worked in the coal mines but we learned a lot about our Italian culture. She says, I guess I'm Attalachian. And I said, yeah, I guess you are. And then I've heard different people that are in the region through their parents, through various professions and things. And so I met a woman who said, well, I must be Asialachian. And I said, yeah, you're Asialachian. Yeah, yes, you are. And a variety of things that happen that way. So anytime that you can come across something that gives you a stronger sense of self-identity, that it's important to have. The name, what we call ourselves, is important. And I think it's grown, you know, when Frank coined the term, he was speaking of a particular experience that he had, and he was speaking of a particular group of people, those, you know, 10 of us that met in the back room of a coffee house and were trying to write and try to figure out who we were and how we fit in with other writers. But I think since then, in the 25 years since he coined that term, it has expanded and given a lot of people, you know, people call the Carolina chocolate drops Afro-Latchian, and musicians that are Afro-Latchian, and other, you know, visual artists that are consider themselves Afro-Latchian. And it's sort of a back-straightening, empowering word that has long since gone on beyond his original intention. And I think that's a wonderful thing too.
That was Afro-Latchian poet and Appalachian writer in residence at Berea College, Crystal Wilkinson. While the Afro-Latchian Poets is a formal group that helps to shine a spotlight on social justice issues through the work of minority poets, writers, and authors from Appalachia, there are poets all around who might not find their way into the spotlight. The voices shared in an informal setting can be just as powerful and inspirational as those in a formal group. After all, it's not always easy to find an open mic night in places like McDowell County, West Virginia. So I wanted to reach out to a young African American who grew up in Appalachia and share a story of what I thought would be an ordinary Afro-Latchian family. One of my former students, James Riley, invited me into his childhood home in McDowell County to meet his family, including his mother. He says it was his mom who influenced his decision to go to college, and as I found out, Paula Riley Thomas is also a bit of a poet herself.
I can't say enough about him. That's my life.
She was a huge help, and at school there was a program called Upward Bound. They took me on tours to different colleges in the area, even a couple out of state, and just showed me that there's more to life than, you know, McDowell County and what it has to offer.
Jobs around here is it's really bad. You can't hardly get one. And I always wanted him to be able to get the job that he wanted outside of West Virginia, anywhere that he wanted to go.
Being here, she knew I wouldn't be happy with just working at the jail or working at Walmart or, you know, doing the few things that were available here, you know, and she always wanted more for me. And she made me realize that I wanted more for myself as well.
Was that hard for you to encourage him to, I mean, this means that he's going to be, you know, he's trying to move away now. Was that hard for you to encourage him?
Don't make me cry. I encouraged him without even thinking about him moving away, even though I knew he wasn't going to be here. Just, I guess if I thought about it too much, I wouldn't have pushed him as hard, because I always wanted to keep him, and he's my baby. He's the only child.
I think it's just a thing, like, you're always going to want your kids to make it farther than you did, and that's why you kind of work hard to make the path a little bit easier for them, which is something my mom did. She worked tirelessly day in and day out to make sure that I had the resources I need, the encouragement I need, the prayers I needed to make it through college.
Paula did move away once. She was living in Alexandria, Virginia in 1992 when James was born. But she moved back when James was a year old.
I moved back here with my mom and survived a domestic abuse relationship, and that's why I came back home.
She worked at the Children's Home Society of West Virginia for about 10 years, and when she lost her job, she needed help.
I had to go on public assistance, which was embarrassing for me. But I had to think about my child. We had to make it.
There's a lot of places that it seems like you could have lost hope.
Oh, yes. Because I've been raped several times when I was in D.C. I can't tell you how good God has been to me. I should have been dead a long time ago. But with God, I was meant to be here. My son, he saved my life. Anytime I was ready to give up, I never wanted to leave him alone.
Paula says the first rape happened years before James was born. Ever since then, she didn't feel clean. But she kept her faith and remembered what she learned in church, that Jesus loves her, the Son of God, according to the Christian theology. And when she had her own son, it brought an inexplicable joy, strength, and desire to live. She writes about the day James was born in a poem called Colors of Life and Love. The colors in the poem represent key people and memories from that day. The halls of yellow represents the hospital. Pink were the doctors and nurse. Brown is Paula's sisters. Green is her mother. Blue is James. And red is health complications she had and blood.
The congrats started with the faces of Pink, looking in the face of the woman dressed in green, and happy with the color of blue. Now concerned with the burst of red, but thankful and happy with the warmth of sunny yellow, seeing the sisters with faces of brown. Homeward bound in the hallways of yellow, saying goodbye to the faces of pink, blessed with the bundle of joy, dressed in blue, seeing the sisters with faces of brown, loving the sight of the woman dressed in green. No stopping me now, no color of red. Appointment to visit the faces of pink after months of the hallways of yellow. The color of happiness is the blessing of blue. Clean bill of health and no sign of red. Still with me, the woman dressed in green. Mother with the colors of life and love, with the faces of brown. The rainbow of pink, an angel, the woman dressed in green. The gift from God in the color of blue. No sign of danger, no color of red. The peace and warmth of yellow. All around, smiling faces of brown.
The yellow color is my color of joy. The helpful color of pink. The heavenly colors of green, blue, and brown. And in remembrance of my Heavenly Father, it's the color of red.
That was Paula Riley Thomas from McDowell County reading her poem called Colors of Life and Love. Paula wrote this shortly after she moved back to McDowell County in 1993. And while she's not in the formal Afro-Latchian Poets group, she is an Afro-Latchian poet. We've talked a lot on our show today about our identity and the perception of what it means to be Appalachian. Everyone has prejudices and biases based on our own realities. We often limit ourselves to the idea that another person doesn't deserve a voice or an identity because they look different, think different, or even have a different political view. But if you spend some time with folks of differing opinions, you will learn something. Do you have to be tolerant of folks who don't seem to listen to you? Well, I say, if you're around people who constantly want to tell you why you're wrong and don't have the time to hear your voice and understand where you're coming from without judgment, then, well, maybe you do need a change of friends. But only for a time. Don't give up on them. And if you truly believe that there is good in this world, that people are generally good, then perhaps you will find the patience to stay on the journey toward understanding, more happiness, and more peace, even as we fight for our own identities. So, keep telling your story, keep telling the truth, and sharing your reality, even if you think no one is listening. Till next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WMMT and Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky, and the Appalachian Studies Association. Music in today's show was provided by Rihanna Giddens, as heard on Mountain Stage. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Thanks for listening to this classic episode of Inside Appalachia, which originally aired last December. We wanted to thank Heroes or Gang Leaders and Marisa Anderson for providing some of the music in this episode. And just a reminder, you can find more information about the Afro-Latchian Poets and our Struggle to Stay series on our website, wvpublic.org.
Are y'all ready? Lights in the valley, loud shine the sun. Lights in the valley, loud shine the sun. Lights in the valley. Lights in the valley, I'll shine the sun. Lights in the valley, I'll shine the sun. Lights in the valley, I'll shine the sun.